Good morning. So today we're going to do some exam review. So as I've done before, hello. Today we're doing some exam review. So I'll just take your questions, and after I collect a reasonable number of questions, I'll try to put them in some order, and we'll go through them in order. If you don't have any questions, I'll just look out. I assume you have questions, though, so. Show hands, and we'll just start collecting them. Yes?
Figuring out spatial and temporal locality from the...
LRU. Okay, what is LRU?
Or as in, like, how do you, like, calculating misses and, like, the axes, like, what we have to do in catch live and see.
Okay. LRU. Okay. Cache optimizations, as in like cache blocking or changing how the cache. Okay, cache parameter change effects. Okay. Yeah. Aliasing. What it is, why it matters. Yes. Okay. Okay. Honey over here. Yeah.
Do you mind do a question?
What? Yes, with the caveat that I do not have any of the past exams memorized, so you need to tell me what the question is. Which are about?
Are about cache in general.
Can you be more specific?
Number 5 is about which cache has fewest misses.
Fewest misses, okay.
And number 9 is about like accessing an array, different elements from an array.
And counting the misses?
And, yes.
Yes. Okay, so write policies, write back through. Okay. Yeah. Bubbling versus stalling. Okay. Other topics people would like me to talk about? Yeah.
Oh, like right now?
I mean, eventually. I'm going to collect all these and then sort them. No? Okay. Yeah. For what? Sorry? For caches? Right. Oh. Data hazards. Or okay. Okay. Yeah.
In the first exam, we're not expected to write HCL code on the exam. Is that
hold
for this one?
Okay. Well, writing HCL code. Okay.
Can you talk about stalling and bubbling for data hazards? Could you also just like more generally go over data hazards? So like when it comes to group instructions, and I know that there was some different instructions in the past that were worked.
So data hazards with what instructions?
Group instructions.
So loads, use, store, etc., and load store. Is that what you're concerned about?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Can we go over control hazards?
Okay. Anything in specific? Or just in general? Okay. Okay. I think. Yeah. Which are about. Okay. Issue rate 5 and 6, okay. Issue rate, etc. Okay, so let's sort these by topic. We'll put these up here. Spatial locality, aliasing down here. That can go together. That can go together. Right policies. That probably goes in there. Lane installing. Okay. So first, functional unit issue rate on exam 3, not 2. So we'll talk about that topic, but we'll talk about it after this exam. Writing HCL code. Again, the same policy applies. We will not require you to actually write HCL code, but we reserve the right to put HCL code on the exam to describe a circuit, or to ask you about how you would do something in HCL generally, but we won't require you to memorize register numbers or I codes or exactly what, whether it's reg, input M or E or B or Q, and so on. So, writing to read or explain or understand how to write. Okay, so spatial and temporal locality in loops. So generally, if you have some sort of loop, 0 in this some sort of loops, and you see J, the rule of thumb is if you see, say, A of I times M plus J, is that J changes most frequently. And if N is big, if M is big here, then all that matters. Then most of what matters. So if M is big, then yes, we have to worry about the outer loop, but those iterations of the outer loop are so infrequent relative to the inner loop that for locality, almost all the effect is the innermost loop, just because we have to wait so long until I changes. So the way I like thinking about this is, answer a question, what sequence of values is accessed? And if we think about this, we have if I equals 0, just to choose an I, arbitrarily, then we access A0, J equals 0, A1, J equals 1, A2, A3, and so on. And then we ask the questions. Temporal locality. Are we accessing the same value twice? Twice close in time. And definitely not close in time. And in fact, we're not ever accessing the same value twice if we look at the whole thing. Depending on what n and m are. Depending on what n and m are, we might be accessing the values twice, but we definitely aren't accessing them close in time. We have to go through that whole inner loop before we have any chance of ever accessing, say, A2 again. Time, and then spatial locality, are we accessing close by values close in time? And the answer is clearly yes, because A0 and A1 are close, A1 and A2 are close, etc. And they're accessed right next to each other. So to give another example, we could have B of J plus I times 10. B of I times 10 to start out with. So if we think about the access pattern here, we're accessing B of 0, 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 B of 0. So the answer to that question would be B of 0 and B of 0 and B of 0. So on, yes, we are. We have tons of temporal locality. Are we accessing close by values close in time? Well, you know, we're not, no, we're just accessing one value over and over again. And B of, and eventually, you know, if we think of the access pattern, eventually we're going to go to B of 10 next. So it's not great. It's not horrible. Okay, it's kind of close, but it's not as good as A is to spatial locality. Where if we look at A, when we access a different value, we're accessing something that's right next to it. With B, when we access a different value, we're skipping pretty far. Not really far, but a little bit. Kind of close. And that also doesn't happen very frequently. Kind of close, not very frequent. To skip ahead, not very frequent, outer loop. You know, M is large. If M is small, then yes, we'd skip ahead more frequently. So if M was like 20, like, then we might be more concerned about that. So these are the general, and we can have like another example of like, C of j times 1,000, so there we're accessing C, 1,000, 2,000, and so on. Are we accessing the same value close in time? For C, no. We do, you know, if M is small, yes for C. C zero, then M's, and iterators later, C zero again, etc. So if M was small, then C, we'd have some temporal locality, but not like B's. And are we accessing close by values close in time? No. For C, we're skipping ahead by 1,000. Like, those aren't close to each other. They're never gonna be in the same cache block. It's just way too big for a cache block. So, any questions on this sort of logic? So generally, the rule of thumb is that you look at the innermost loop, you know, mostly only innermost loop matters, and the exception is not too many iterations of innermost loop, in which case you work outwards, and the innermost loop is what matters because that's what there's the most of, and you just look at, you know, just write down like what are the addresses we're accessing, like to look at whether they're close to each other or not. In both, in terms of duplication or time. Yes?
Does it matter that we use M
also using M? The reason I did that is so we could hypothetically talk about M being small while N isn't. So if M is small, like, then we have to worry about, say, C, you know, that we might have some temporal locality that matters. If M is big, it's not going to matter. We're accessing too much stuff. Okay, so LRU identifying this is just what we did on the cache lab. So procedure, if I have an access pattern, so if I have cache parameters, and an access pattern. So step one, find the size of the index and offset bits. Find the number of index and offset bits. That should be the first thing you do when you actually need to know, not like approximately what misses there are, but exactly. Like if you need to know, like, is this better? Like the easiest, you know, hopefully, like there's obviously better locality, but that won't always be the case. If you want to know exactly how many misses there are, first you want to find out how the addresses are split up for the cache. So you need to find the index and offset bits. You could also find the tag bits, but that's, remember, you just, once you take out the index and offset bits from an address, you know exactly where the tag bits are. So you find out how many of them there are. And note that even if you don't know the exact addresses, generally you can assume, you can at least know like what things will have the same index and offset, you know, or based on you know, assuming the array starts somewhere, you know that things that are apart by the appropriate power of 2 have the same index and offset bits because you're adding something which is all zeros in those bottom bits. And step 2 is find the index of everything being accessed. And note that you don't care about the offset for the purpose of is it a miss or a hit, because you always access, the cache always brings in a whole block. So you can just discard the offsets, they don't matter for counting misses. So then in order, so then look at each set. So for each set, which means accesses with the same index. So take each possible index that's used in your access pattern and just look at the accesses to that index. You can analyze each set separately because what happens in one set doesn't actually affect another. And go in order to accesses. And A, check if it is already in the set. And initially it's not, unless you're told not, probably. No implies miss, yes implies hit. B, so second part is if it's a miss, say miss, replace something in the set. So you have two options. So if there is if not all the blocks in the set are used, put it there. So if you have an empty slot in the set, based on the number of blocks per set in the cache parameters have, then put it in that block. We always want to use some space. Otherwise, follow replacement policy. So C, which for LRU means least recently accessed block previously. So you can look up, find out other things that are in my cache, when's the last time each was accessed? No. E.g., look at previous accesses to blocks in the set. So just look at all the blocks in the set, say, let's look at the access pattern, where was this block last accessed? Remembering that the access might be to the middle of the block, but it matters that it's the block. So, index, nor the block offset for finding misses. That you can just ignore the block offset. In fact, it's probably better to just write your addresses without the block offset. Yeah?
What is the main use for the block offset again?
The block offset is, we have a cache block, which like might have 8 bytes, and we want 1 byte of it. Which 1 byte is that? So when we're accessing the cache for real, we definitely need it, but as far as the cache is concerned, it's as if we just request blocks, and later on we figure out what part we want. And for other policies, you do something different. For FIFO, you'd say, what's the last block I put in? Typically, you do this by just having the blocks in the order you inserted them. So you can just round robin. For random, you just make a random choice. Presumably, we wouldn't ask you about that because we'd have to have you make consistent random choices somehow. Yes?
For the slide
that you
have where it's got like all the list of like the formulas to get like the number of index bits and offset bits.
Question is, the formulas for finding the tag index and offset bits, do you have to memorize those? If that's what you need to do, yes, because we will not provide them. We know that, like, as Junior discussed, like, you can, like, reason this out, like, you know, number of bytes in the cache is the number of blocks total, and you know that there's so many blocks per set and so many sets, and you know that you need to use all the index bits to fit by the set. So you can like memorize not the formulas, but sort of what they mean, and that should be enough to figure out the formulas and write them down on the exam. Okay. That's something in the stack. So that's the procedure for generally solving these problems. So sometimes, you know, we have access patterns where we like might not tell you the exact address, you know, e.g. if you have array of x, you know, assume the array starts at some address, e.g. 0, and work out the index. You know, by knowing how big the array is, you can compute the exact address of array of x and figure that out that way. And that's how you do it. Like, instead of a list of addresses, we give you here some C code. And usually when we give that problems, we will hopefully if you have array of x, we've told you enough to know that values don't overlap in two blocks. And if you look at past exam questions, we've usually like told you the array is in a multiple of something to guarantee that doesn't happen, because if it does, it's really makes things a lot more annoying. Like, you have to worry, I'm accessing values in two different blocks. Like, how does that work? Yeah, we don't want you, like, we generally avoid that, and compilers generally avoid generating that code. Okay, so that's the general procedure. So let's apply this to our past exams, fall 2017. Exam. Question 5. Okay, so well, question 5 probably needs some special explanation. So this is question 5, which indeed was one of the most gotten wrong questions on this exam. So this question says we have a 2 meg array, and we have code which is reading every byte of the 2 meg array continuously over and over again, 1,000 times. So note that since this is a 2 meg array, and all these caches are less than 2 megs, we cannot possibly fit the entire array in the cache. Well, that just is not possible. So the question is going to be, like, do we manage to get any hits despite this being too big for these caches? And this is going to be based on the replacement policy. So if we consider the 1.75 megabyte fully associative cache with that FIFO replacement policy, so we access the first 1.75 megabytes of the array, and then the next thing we access, we need to figure out how do I replace something. And since it's a fully associative cache, that means that everything is in one set. So everything's a candidate to be replaced. So we're going to replace the first part of the array we accessed. And if we think about this access pattern, we know we're going to access that again after we replaced it. And so what ends up happening is that here is that we have our 2 megabyte array. So this is 2 MB, and we have 1.75 MB. And that initially we cache all this stuff on our first of 1,000 accesses with that. And then we access a little bit here. And that is going to evict from here. Then we access a little bit here. That's going to evict from here. By the FIFO policy, the first thing we put in is back there. And so eventually we're going to access all of this stuff, put it in our cache, and evict all of this stuff, which is exactly the next thing we access. Then next, we access all of this stuff and evict all of this stuff, which is now the least recently used thing we access. And we're always kind of chasing our tail. So it turns out we have no hits with the LRU policy, with the FIFO policy for the 1.75 megabyte. And if we think about the 0.5 megabyte direct mapped, similar things are going to happen. So we have, with 0.5 megabyte direct maps, we have our 2 meg array. We access the first 0.5 megabytes. And then when we access here, remember that because the size of each way is 0.5 megabytes, that this here and this here and this here and this here and so on all map to the same set. So when we access a little bit of stuff, so initially we access, the beginning, we put this into the cache, and then when we access a little bit of stuff here, that evicts stuff from here, and so on. And again, we're always chasing our tail. We access the next 0.5 megabytes, and that needs to go in the exact same places in the cache that the first did, so we end up evicting this first block, and then we access the next 0.5 megabytes, and that evicts this, because they go to the same place, and we only have one slot, and so on. And then we had a 1 megabyte with LRU and 8 ways. So in the 1 megabyte with LRU, we have something similar going on. So we access our first 1 megabyte, and this fits in the cache. And then we access this chunk here. Now we have 8 ways. So this chunk here goes to the same place as here, this little here, and there's like 8 of these. Because remember that the way the cache works is that every 1 meg divided by 8, things map to the same set. And we're using LRU, so we're going to actually evict from here. So this is what's evicted. We do that, so we access the first part and we evict there. And then we access the next 1/8 megabytes. And that's going to evict. Now it's now least recently used, which is back here. And again, we're just always chasing our tail, evicting what we just put in. So we have option A, which I did first. And this has a random replacement policy. And because it has a random replacement policy, sometimes we will get lucky. And because we're accessing things twice, we will have some hits. And since all the other options have no hits, that random replacement policy is what wins. Yes?
So if you have a replacement policy that doesn't expect a sequential access pattern, then you're not going to get hits in this case because you're constantly chasing your tail.
So the question is, if I have a replacement policy that doesn't expect a sequential access pattern, I'm not going to get hits, assuming it's too big for the cache, yes. And in real caches, so for example, Intel apparently does something where they have tried to detect if you're doing this kind of sequential access and switch to a different replacement policy other than pseudo LRU. Precisely because of this problem. Yeah.
In the case, if for each of those blocks, when we're accessing them, and we're reading just bytes at a time, aren't we gonna take a hit on those individual bytes?
So the question is, are we gonna take a hit on the individual bytes? Yes. So the question isn't there spatial locality in this access pattern? Doesn't that give us some hits? Yes. So there are cache hits. And the question is about fewest misses. So the thing which affects how many hits there are for that is the block size. If we had megabyte blocks, well, then sure, we might be missing every time. But if everything's in 1 megabyte block, we have at most 2 misses for each pair of accesses. And you can see that we have 64 bytes for A, C, and D. And 32 bytes for C. So B and D are, we know B and D, since they have the same block size as A, are gonna have at least as many hits, because we're gonna have a miss to each block every iteration. And we know A is gonna have less than that. And if we think about C, it has smaller blocks, so we have more of them, and we have a miss to each one every iteration, so we're gonna have strictly more hits than B or D.
Okay.
strictly more misses than B or D. So the block size is another reason why C can't be right. Yeah?
Is it fair to say that for this question, the number of ways doesn't really matter?
So the question is, for this question, the number of ways doesn't matter? That's right. Because and one way of thinking about that is to remember our classification of misses. These are all capacity misses. They're not conflict misses. Adding ways address conflict misses, but these are all capacity misses. And sort of one way of defining what's a capacity miss is that if I change this question to just say fully associative for every cache, nothing would change.
Is it possible to go over the different types of, I guess, misses?
I will add that to the list for later. Okay, so wins. Key. So summary of that. And then we have question 9 on the same exam. So let's look at what question 9 is. Okay, right, this question. So question 9 we have an array. A loop which accesses an array. Note that the outer loop is an X, which is not used to access the array, so we're just repeating accesses to array 0, 128, 256, so on, up to 2k, and that plus 1, that plus I, so array 0, 129, 258, and so on. And the first question is, if we have a 1k direct map cache with 1k with 1 byte cache blocks, how many data cache misses will we have? And we assume it's originally empty, and the assumptions say only array is kept in memory, everything else is in registers. It's the only accesses in that the compiler doesn't do anything tricky of let's keep array 0 in a register for you. No, it doesn't do that.
And block sizes are 1 byte?
And the block size is 1 byte.
Okay.
Yes, so let's draw another picture for this. So because we have a 1K cache, so I can write, we'll draw this out where we have, I should do this black. We have set 0 all the way to set 1023 in our cache. And we know that array of 0 maps here, and so on. And we have array of 128 maps here, and so on. And our access pattern is 0, 128, 256, and so on. And notably, we end up going to array of 1024, array of 1024 plus 128, and so on. So we have, when I equals 0 and I equals 8, we access the same set. When I equals 1 and I equals 9, we access the same set, and so on. And because this is a direct map cache, in each of these slots here, we can only fit one thing. So this means all the accesses to array I times 128, so when x equals 0, the first iteration, they're compulsory misses. They couldn't be in the cache at all. This is x16. When x is greater than 0, they are conflict misses, because we access array 1024 before we access array 0 the second time. So we always evict it. Again, this is another case of we're chasing our tail, even though we're not using the whole cache. So we have 16 conflict misses. So just to remind you, the structure of the loop is for x from 0 to 9, for I from 0 to 15, we access array I times 128 and array I times 128 plus 1 plus I. So that's the so we've dealt with the accesses to array I times 128, and we have 160 misses to that. So then we need to deal with the accesses to array 128 times I. So there, we're accessing array of 0. I should probably use a different, different color. So we have array of 0. So I'll draw this out again for that. So we have array of 0, array of 129, and so on. And when we wrap around, we don't wrap around to 1024. We wrap around to array of 1024 plus 8. And array of 1024 plus 128 plus 9, and so on. And you'll see that these never overlap. These always are different spaces, and since each block is one byte, so array of 129 is in a different block than array of 128 and array of 128 and then array of 1024. They're all in different blocks because we have one byte blocks. So even though they're not, because they're not exactly 1024 apart, we don't have any extra space in the block. So these are all different blocks. So all of these block, so everything besides I equals 0 is not a block we've used, not a set we've used before. So this is set 129, this is set 8, this is set 128 plus 9, and so on. So these are all sets we don't use before. So the pattern for here is that the first iteration we have compulsory misses for everything but array 0. For array 0, this is the same. So we have 15 compulsory misses plus one hit for array 0 because we assume we access this first. That's where we're counting the miss, and that's enough for you. And then after that, for x greater than 0, we have one hit for 0 again because we access that. And other than that, everything is in a set we haven't don't use for anything else. We aren't running out of space in any of the sets. So there are 15 hits. So we end up with 160 plus 15. And this gives us 175. Okay, questions about this?
Where did the
1024
come from?
Where did 1024 as the interval between sets?
Yeah.
That came because we have one byte blocks and 1024 way sets. I mean, it's a 1K byte cache is the key thing. And it's direct map, so 1 kilobyte away, and that's the interval. Yes.
So how do you get 160?
So 160 is because for accesses to array I times 128, we determine that they're all misses. The first time they're compulsory, the next time we have a conflict between 0 and well, I times 128 and I times 128 times plus 1024. And you know, vice versa, when we're accessing array 0 evicts 1024, accessing 1024 evicts 0. And the same is true for every other pair. Yes.
Is it 15 hits or misses?
For which?
that you wrote in red right there?
That's 15 misses.
Okay.
So only the compulsory misses.
Okay.
And we don't have the one for array 0 because it's the same thing as I times 1 to my eights, 0. Yeah?
Can you explain the 15 eights again one
time? They're hits because if we think of, to give one example, array of 129, this is in set 129 of the cache. And if we look at every access, we never access what set 129 in between when we access it when x equals 0. So it's still going to be there. So we just look set by set, like I told you, like we see, nothing else uses that set. So it's still a hit. Other questions? Yes. And this is indeed, oh, right, one of the most confusing questions on exam. That's great. I guess we're doing that way. Okay, there we go. So, next question thing is cache parameter effects. So, we have different cache parameters we can think about. So a catch, which is what else changes. So if I say, you know, we have number of sets, number block size, and associativity, plus increase the associativity, this implies cache size increases versus associativity only. Versus if I have, you know, total size, increase associativity. This does not imply the cache size increases because I told you it didn't. Instead, this implies that the number of sets decreases. And this has to do with other effects. So increasing the associativity, well, generally decreases, so we'll do some parameters. So associativity, if we plus, associativity plus implies less conflict misses. Cache size plus implies less capacity misses. Block size plus implies less compulsory misses, more conflict misses, conflict misses with the caveat that conflict misses depending on what else changes. So if you increase the block size and keep the associativity the same, that will generally be more conflict misses. But like, there's very different things you could change when doing it. Like if you make the cache bigger, that can mean not more conflict misses when you increase the block size. The rule of thumb is less sets, more conflicts. And usually increasing the block size decreases the number of sets. So I guess I should say number of sets minus more conflict misses. Usually there's less places to put things, I guess. Or sorry, not number of sets minus, with, I guess that's only with if number of blocks a set is the same. If it's not the same, then that's sensitivity. Yeah?
Why does increasing block size cause less compulsory misses?
So the question is, why does increasing block size cause less compulsory misses? And the justification is that, let's say we're accessing a 0, a 1, a 2, you know, with block size 0, miss, with block size 1, with block size 2, we have miss, hit because of a 0, miss, and so on. Miss, hit, a 1, a 2, and so on. And you can get that even if it's not perfect spatial locality, but there's more possibilities there. And these were compulsory misses. I just skip ahead to types of misses since I've had enough questions on it. So types of misses. So compulsory, still a miss with infinite cache size. If I make the cache infinitely big, I still have this miss. We have capacity, which is still a miss with associativity equals number of blocks. I have a fully associative, which is the same thing as fully associative. And then we have conflict is not compulsory or capacity, since there are other types of misses, but none we discuss in this class.
You also say because you want to evict something for conflict?
So question is, could we say it's because we want to evict something for something else? That is not going to distinguish between conflict and capacity misses.
Yeah.
So we think about like that 1.75 meg cache and the 2 meg array, like that pattern like doesn't distinguish the two types of problems. Yeah.
Well, if you get a miss evicting something, and you still have places empty in the cache, then you can
say, so a rule of thumb you could say is we're evicting something and there's still space for it. Like, is another way of looking at it. You know. Evicting and still space. Evicting but still space elsewhere. Number of sets, and did I forget any cache parameters effect? Oh, so write back plus, so less misses in general. So write back policy means, or I guess I should say write allocate, that's the more important one. Write back is a little vaguer because we haven't like precisely defined whether write through is a write miss. But write allocate is less misses because usually when we write something, we read it, but not always. And I guess I should say these effects are, you know, so these are what with normal programs. We can always construct a program where like changing the parameters does nothing or makes it worse. Even if for normal programs that wouldn't happen. By having programs which like don't have any locality. Okay, so then we have write policy. So when we do a write, we have two decisions. So writing to a cache. So A, if it's not in the cache yet, should I put it there? This decision is write allocate. And we have a second decision, write back. If it's in the cache now, after we've done anything with write allocate, do I update just that or also memory? So note that this phrasing does not preclude any combination of write allocate, write no allocate, write back, and write through. Write back, write through. I should write the two terms. Right. So if I decide write no allocate, write back, that means that if it's not in the cache yet, do I put it there? Write no allocate would say no. And I look at the other question. If it's in the cache now, that condition doesn't hold, doesn't matter how I answered it. And if I have write allocate, write through, I say if it's not in the cache yet, okay, I'm going to put it there. And I look at the next question. If it's in the cache now, do I update that? Or just that, or also memory? The answer is I also update memory. So all the combinations work, and write back applies need to track what's out of date, which we say dirty. Dirty, one extra bit per block.
It's also the modified bit.
So it's equivalent to a modified bit, yes. That would be a name you could find used for it. We've generally called it a dirty bit. You know, otherwise need to write memory on every eviction, which would be very expensive. And for direct map, so associativity equals number of blocks per set. And direct map is exactly the same thing as associativity equals one. Fully associative is exactly the same thing as associativity equals number of blocks. And set associate is the term we use just when we have to specify the number of ways. So everything's just a special case of a set associative cache. So any questions about any of these cache issues? Okay, so let's talk about bubbling versus stalling. So I think the primary source of confusion is that we have two things we call stalling. Stalling an instruction means keeping the instruction from advancing in our pipeline. Stalling a register means keeping the register from being updated. And when we stalling an instruction, so stalling instruction A, so we'll say B here. So if we have instruction B and our pipeline has fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back, and we have instruction like so, E. So normally, so what would normally happen, normal advance would be like, I should write this E, D, C, E, A, and we'll stall D. Normally, we get F, E, D, C, B in the pipeline. Stalling B, D, we want what happened next would be E and D. D doesn't advance, and that means E can't advance either, or else we've forgotten about, unless we're like deliberately want to forget about E. And typically, if we don't tell you, you probably don't want to do that, right? And D and C presumably just advance as usual. C and B usually advance as usual. And we have this, this empty slot here. So to achieve this, we stall registers containing values for E, D, and we also need to replace, make star not be another copy of D, which means we bubble registers, register for execute. So E containing E is, fetch the PC. Containing D is fetch to decode. Bubble register for decode to execute. And so bubbling insert and up. Bubbling a register. Make it output A. Next cycle. And for stalling, data. Yeah. So stalling an instruction typically involves, setting both, doing some combination of stall, what we call stalling a register and bubbling a register. So stalling and bubbling for data hazards. So most of the time, we can forward without stalling. Otherwise, we have two questions. So one, when is the value we need computed? And two, when is the value we need used? We need to answer these two questions. So one example. So example is the load use hazard in our five-stage pipeline. So five-stage pipeline with, say, M, R move Q, RAX, RAX, and add Q, RAX, RAX. So answer to question one, near the end of the memory stage of MR move Q. Answer to question two, when is it used? Near the beginning of the execute stage of add Q. And we need to arrange things so one and two don't happen in the wrong order. Like, we need to compute the value before we use it. And so that means when we line up these instructions that we have our fetch, decode, execute, memory write back for this. And it needs to be the case that since we can't start execute until after memory of add Q, so the execute for add Q needs to be there. And based on that, I can place all the other stages. I can say we're going to have decode there and fetch there. We might end up doing something like this, but as far as how much we're stalling, it doesn't change things. So we could do this, or we could do this. Doesn't matter. I'll write it like this, but we need to line up because, you know, we have here is one is here, and we want to line that up with two. And that's what we're doing here. We're lining up one and two. So if we did something like, so possible so if we did something like this, then our two is back in time. So that's how we know that's how you determine when you need to stall, and the mechanics are you figure out what cycle you're stalling the instruction on, which you've generally had a choice. You may have not used that in FIFO Mark II, but you had the choice. Like, you can implement it correctly by stalling in fetch or decode, for example, as long as you get the right values there and don't like compute too much in a cycle. So I guess, so data hazards in load store, I guess that inadvertently goes over data hazards in load store. So load creates hazards in the five-stage processor because memory is after execute. You know, other pipelines would have different pipelines would have different hazards, e.g. two execute stages or something like that would create more hazards. But the reason we have hazards there, e.g. like two decode stages, let's say, if decode is really long for some reason or write back is long, we would have more hazards that create, sorry, hazards which need stalling. In that. We have hazards all the time, so might create different hazards, either two decode stages or different execute stages. You know, I guess the order will change. But the general rule, you know, is you follow these questions. You know, and that solves it for any pipeline, including ours. Correct by stalling, and I should note, end forwarding. That we have to forward to do this. If we can, you know, if we correct by stalling only, if we can't forward, then the answer to these questions is one, near the end of right back. You know, at the end of right back, end of right back. And two, near the beginning of decode. So if we can't forward, the question, answers to the questions are much worse and we need to do a lot more stalling. And that's how you reason about what if we're stalling for data hazards. That's how it would work. You just say, well, we can't forward, so we need to rely on the register file to send the value. Yes? So why do we need it near the beginning of the decode? Because remember how our register file works. It takes in a value and during the cycle reads it. And that value needs to be available sometime during the cycle, probably relatively near the beginning. Like, we don't want to like wire memory to the register file and make our cycle time really long. Okay, so control hazards. So we had two control hazards we talked about. So we had the general pattern is didn't know correct PC. So examples were return, need to read it from memory, and JXX, need condition codes. PC and fetch. And we had different solutions for this. So solution one, don't fetch new instructions until we know the PC. So stall the next instruction. So we're stalling, because actually we're starting to run the next instruction, but we don't know how, so we're just stalling its fetch stage. That's one way of viewing that. And solution two is make a guess and correct it later, which is branch prediction. So this is later on replace instructions with nops. Nops also keep any permanent changes from being made. E.g., don't let them update the condition codes. Which, by the way, if you failed JXX OpQ squash, that's what you were doing wrong. So those are our two general options for doing that. And you have to do both for Pipe Homework 2. The condition codes or restore old values, restore values of changed registers. Yeah, so in a more complicated pipeline where like we couldn't stop the instruction until it got further on, we might have it like it might have written a register and we need to undo that somehow. We didn't have to do that because, you know, if you implemented things like we said, you stopped the instructions before they got to execute. If you didn't quite do it, you at least stopped them in execute, where you could have just stopped them from running the condition codes. And that was enough. But in a more complicated scenario, you might need to worry about like undoing a write to memory or something like that. Let's do this last question and then we'll see if there's time for round two. So aliasing, what is it? When we have two names for one value. So example, X10 is the same thing as Y10, or Y0. And it matters because, you know, makes some optimizations we want to do incorrect. And we had some examples, so e.g., e.g. changing loop order on. That doesn't work if, you know, so if A and B are set up like X and Y above, then changing the loop order on that loop is wrong. Like, it produces the different answer and the compiler can't do it. So these sorts of scenarios come up all the time with where you might want the compiler to do some optimization techniques we learned about for you. It creates, makes it troublesome to do that. You know, e.g. removing redundant loads through a pointer. Like, you're accessing something through a pointer, but if there might be another pointer to that, the compiler can't just, keep it in the register. It needs to say, oh, does this statement change that thing that's pointing to? I don't know. So that's the list of topics I had. So other questions, since I have 7-ish minutes. Yeah.
Are you allowed to say like the percentage of each of these topics?
The question is, what's the relative coverage of each topic? Coverage will be roughly proportional to the amount of lectures between the last exam and this exam on each topic. So what would a picture of what a cache looks like be? So I usually would draw the, so we have, I usually draw it in a way where we have set 0, set 1, set 2, and each set has a number of ways. We'll draw, say, 2 ways here, 0, way 1, set 2 to the I. And in each way, we have a valid bit, and we have a tag, and we have the blocks, which contain 2 to the B bytes. 2 to the little B bytes, and this should be 2 to the little I. Consistent with what our book does. And we might have some other metadata, like a dirty bit, let's say, if this is a write-back cache. This is the usual picture I make if I were doing that. And we might also have, like, replacement policy info, like LRU. Yeah.
If you're doing an LRU question, do you usually, how do you keep track of, like, the LRU information on?
So the question is, if I'm doing something with LRU, how do I keep track of the information? So usually, if you're doing a question we have you do by hand, you can just like look backwards in the access pattern to find out. Obviously, that's not a valid solution for implementation. And like when you have two ways, you can just like put an X, like you can just like mark which one is least recently used, which is for two-way LRU is what the processor is doing. It just has a bit which says which is least recently used, and it flips that bit when it needs to. On reads potentially.
Otherwise, does it need to like resort a list, like if it's a k-way system?
So, question is, what if we want to do LRU on a higher way count? So, if it's like 8 or more ways, probably the processor does not implement true LRU.
Okay.
Because that is not worth the complexity involved in implementing it. Conceptually, to implement it, you just need to maintain a sorted list a list ordered by access and update that in every access. This is like, it's straightforward to do by hand. It's not straightforward to come up with an efficient way for hardware to do it, which is why for like at least 8 ways or higher, I don't know of any processor which really does it. Maybe on like an L3 cache where you can pay in very high costs. Usually they'll do some approximation. And an example of an approximation is like, you get most of the benefit of LRU if you just know about like the things you've which things haven't been accessed very recently. Like if you can like mark half the blocks that have been accessed most recently, like that's almost all the benefit of LRU.
So they have extra bits, like probably marking.
Holding some other type of information, but that approximates it. And the big thing you want to do is that if you just access something recently, you don't want to evict that one. But if you don't precisely match, like which of the 8 things is least recently used, you're not losing too much. If you like, if 3 of them are kind of close and haven't been used that recently. Other topics in my last 3 minutes people would like me to cover, or else I'll just be done. Okay. Question. So logistical note. So Wednesday, this lab is just, it's listed as exam review. It's time for you to ask the TAs questions. If the TAs want to run something more review session-y, that's up to them. They can figure out what makes sense, which probably depends on how populated the lab is.